welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've just returned from a month in Africa. My visit was filled with amazing sights, experiences, and fascinating people. Africa has such an incredible tradition of storytelling, and African literature has a perspective that can be so different from the West. I loved putting this show together, a mix of fiction and nonfiction, classics and contemporary works. I believe you'll find much to enjoy as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Nelson Mandela is one of the great moral and political leaders of our time, an uncommon man whose lifelong dedication to the fight against racial oppression in South Africa won him the Nobel Peace Prize and the presidency of his country. If you haven't already read it, his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, will surprise and inspire you. Michael Boatman performs the audio edition.
I cite his efforts as President of the Republic of South Africa to create the political, economic, and social conditions needed to bring Africa the peace and prosperity it needs and deserves. Above all, I cite his ready willingness to embrace and reconcile with those who persecuted him the most, and the grace with which he stuck to his promise to serve only one presidential term of office. His contribution did not end there. To this day, Madiba remains probably the single most admired, most respected international figure in the entire world. He continues to inspire millions of people and several generations throughout the globe by continuing to fight for reconciliation before recrimination, healing before bitterness, peace before conflict. By fighting for health, for education, for the right of every child to have a better start in life. By spelling out the right and duty of not only South Africa, but of all Africa to take charge of its own future and fate. As he said in one of his many eloquent speeches, and I quote, "Africa has long traversed past a mindset that seeks to heap all blame on the past and on others." End of quote. The only adequate way in which we can truly express our gratitude for Madiba's contribution is for every one of us to work every day to follow his example. If just one small part of what he has sought to achieve for his fellow human beings is translated into reality, if we live up to just one fraction of the standards he has set for himself, then Africa and the world will be a far, far better place.
Africa, Magu Benjalo, Magu Benjalo. Kute kubenguna pakate, kute kubenguna pakate.
I dedicate this book to my six children, Madiba and Makaziwe, my first daughter, who are now deceased, and to Makato, Makaziwe, Zenani, and Zinzi, whose support and love I treasure. To my 21 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren who give me great pleasure, and to all my comrades, friends, and fellow South Africans whom I serve, and whose courage, determination, and patriotism remain my source of inspiration. Acknowledgements. As listeners will discover, this book has a long history. I began writing it clandestinely in 1974 during my imprisonment on Robben Island. Without the tireless labor of my old comrades, Walter Sisulu and Ahmed Kathrada, for reviving my memories, it is doubtful the manuscript would have been completed. The copy of the manuscript which I kept with me was discovered by the authorities and confiscated. However, in addition to their unique calligraphic skills, my co-prisoners Mac Maharaj and Isu Chiba had ensured that the original manuscript safely reached its destination. I resumed work on it after my release from prison in 1990. Since my release, my schedule has been crowded with numerous duties and responsibilities, which have left me little free time for writing. Fortunately, I have had the assistance of dedicated colleagues, friends, and professionals who have helped me complete my work at last, and to whom I would like to express my appreciation.
We've just heard Long Walk to Freedom by Nelson Mandela. Taye Selassie was born in London and raised in Massachusetts. She received her BA from Yale, continued her studies at Oxford, and now lives in Rome. Her story, The Sex Lives of African Girls, was published in 2011 and appears in Best American Short Stories of 2012. Ghana Must Go is her debut novel. Publishers Weekly called the book gorgeous, reminiscent of Jhumpa Lahiri, but with even greater warmth and vibrancy. Welcome, Taye. It's lovely to have you with us on the Book Report.
It's my pleasure.
Ghana Must Go is a very intriguing title. How did you come to choose it?
Well, I always say that it sort of chose me. I started the novel after sort of a flash of insight in a shower in Sweden, of all places. And when I'd written about 10 pages, it came time to save the document. And the first name that came to mind for the then 10-page long manuscript was Ghana Must Go. And when I finished, I considered whether I had, in fact, sort of in that moment selected the right title for the book and determined that indeed I had.
Is the book autobiographical?
It's not. It's not. It is full, however, with autobiographical details. I've said that I think learning to write a novel, which is what you do when you write it, when you write one for the first time, taught me that you can give more attention and more energy to the inner lives of characters, to their motivations, their hopes, their dreams, and so forth, if you are not spending that much time thinking about the superficial details, where they go to school, where they live, the names of the streets, the names of the buildings. And so I just picked things that I know. I had the family grow up in Brookline, Massachusetts, as I did. I had the children go to Yale, as my twin and I did, to Harvard Med, as she did. Father's a surgeon like my dad, and so forth. But the people, the characters, are not my family members, and certainly this story is theirs and not mine.
I learned in the book that one of your characters named Tyro is from the Yoruban meaning to see and taste the world, the first twin. So that's based on, because you're a twin also, is that right?
I'm a twin also. So the all twins, male or female, receive this name in the Yoruba culture, and Taye and Taiwo are two variants on the same name, a bit like Liz and Beth are common variants of Elizabeth. So I chose Taiwo because it's not exactly Taye, but really there was no other name to give the character, having decided that she was a twin.
In the beginning of Ghana Must Go, Kweko dies of a heart attack and really of a broken heart. Give us the background of that story.
Absolutely. So Kweko Sai is a gifted surgeon. As a young child, he left Ghana to study in the United States on a scholarship. There he met his wife, Fola, who is Nigerian and Scottish, and they have 4 children. Olu, the eldest, also becomes a doctor. The twins, as mentioned, Taiwo and Kainde, a girl and a boy, and then the youngest, Sadie. they've lived in the States for years and everything's been going well until Kwaku suffers a devastating humiliation and in his despair leaves his family. So when we find him in his garden dying, as you say, of a heart attack, we are 16 years past the moment in which he abandoned his family, and the rest of the novel, following on from his death, explores what happened to them after he left.
You've coined the term Afropolitans. Talk about that.
It's been an interesting experience for me. I wrote an essay in 2005 trying to get a handle on my own identity, really. When I'm asked, where are you from, I always sort of fumble with the answer. And I thought, listen, there's got to be a better, quicker way to describe this. And Afropolitan was my answer, meaning someone who has a deep and unbreakable tie to a country or countries on the African continent, who has a decidedly global perspective, and who is committed in whatever way to seeing change happen for Africa, for African people, for themselves as Africans in the world. And it was amazing. I wrote that essay really sort of describing my identity, my twin sisters, our cousins, but was amazed and delighted to find that so many African young people around the globe could identify with the term, with the identity, with the experience, such that the term is now sort of widely used.
On a socioeconomic level, Ghana seems to be at the heart of today's African growth and progress. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Ghana is today at the heart and has always been. Ghana was the first African nation to achieve its independence in 1957. We just recently celebrated the anniversary of that. And I think from that moment forward, Ghana has always been at the forefront of African politics. We take democracy really seriously, which I think reflects itself not only in the political life, but as you say, the socioeconomic life of Ghanaian citizens. And since my mom's been living there for the past 15 years, the capital city, Accra, has evolved tremendously, such that now most of my peers, my cousins, our friends that were educated in the so-called West are now thinking of returning home to raise their families.
And are there special challenges of writing about an African family for a Western audience?
I don't believe that I am writing for a Western audience. I don't think that most novelists are really writing for any audience, quite frankly. I think that certainly in my case, the language, the music, the story is of the utmost importance to me. The challenge arises not for me as the novelist, but rather for me as the figure asked always to speak about the political situation of a country that I care about deeply, but that is not my subject as a nation state. So my subject are human beings, and I'm often asked to speak about politics. And that, I think, is the challenge for any African novelist, that we are often conflated with African politicians.
All right. Tell us about your meeting with Toni Morrison.
Surely. I met Professor Morrison when I was finishing my grad degree at Oxford. She came to receive an honorary degree, and by chance we found ourselves at the same dinner. She very kindly reached out when we returned to the States and ultimately gave me a deadline, a year, to produce a piece of writing for her to read. I had struggled for the decade preceding to finish any fiction at all, sort of bound, I think, by a combination of fear and desperate love, really. And when she gave me this deadline, I had no choice but to meet it. And in so doing, I began writing again. I sent her The Sex Lives of African Girls and was trying to make Sex Lives longer when I began Ghana Must Go.
And what's your next project? What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on a novel, my second, which is set in Rome, where I live, and it's a love story.
All right. Well, I very much enjoyed your book, and I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. And now, let's listen to a sampling of Ghana Must Go, narrated by Adjoa Ando.
She sleeps like a child. But he's carried the thought anyway, from bedroom to sunroom, making a production of being careful, a show for himself. He does this, has always done this since leaving the village, little open-air performances for an audience of one, or for two, him and his cameraman, that silent, invisible cameraman who stole away beside him all those decades ago in the darkness before daybreak, with the ocean beside, and who has followed him every day, everywhere since, quietly filming his life, or the life of the man who he wishes to be and who he left to become. In this scene, a bedroom scene, the considerate husband, who doesn't make a peep as he slips from the bed, moving the covers aside noiselessly, setting each foot down separately, taking pains not to wake his unwakeable wife, not to get up too quickly, thus unsettling the mattress, crossing the room very quietly, closing the door without sound, and down the hall in this manner, through the door, into the courtyard, where she clearly can't hear him but still on his toes, across the short heated walkway from master wing to living wing, where he pauses for a moment to admire his house. It's a brilliant arrangement, this one-story compound, by no means novel, but functional and elegantly planned. Simple courtyard in the middle, with a door at each corner to the living, dining, master and guest bedroom wings. He sketched it on a napkin in a hospital cafeteria in his third year of residency, at 31 years old. At 48, bought the plot off a Neapolitan patient, a rich land speculator with mafia ties and type 2 diabetes, who moved to Accra because it reminds him of Naples in the 50s, he says, the wealth pressed against want, fresh sea air against sewage, filthy poor against filthier rich at the beach. At 49, found a carpenter who was willing to build it, the only Ghanaian who didn't balk at putting a hole in a house. The carpenter was 70 with cataracts and a six-pack. He finished in 2 years, working impeccably and alone. At 51, moved his things in, but found it too quiet. At 53, took a second wife. Elegantly planned. Now he stops at the top of the square between doorways, where the blueprint is obvious, where he can see the design, and considers it as the painter must consider the painting, or the mother the newborn, with confusion and awe, that this thing which sprang to life there inside the mind or body has made it here to the outside, a life of its own. Slightly baffled. How did it get here, from in him to in front? Of course he knows. With the proper application of the appropriate instruments, it's the same for the painter, the mother, the amateur architect. But still, it's a wonder to look at. His house. His beautiful, functional, elegant house, which appeared to him whole, the whole ethos, in an instant, like a fertilized zygote spinning inexplicably out of darkness in possession of an entire genetic code, an entire logic. The four quadrants, a nod to symmetry, to his training days, to graph paper, to the compass, perpetual journey, perpetual return, etc., etc. A grey courtyard, not green, polished rock, slabs of slate, treated concrete, a kind of rebuttal to the tropics, to home. So a homeland reimagined, all the lines clean and straight, nothing lush, soft or verdant. In one instant, all there, now here, decades later, on a street in old Adabraka, a crumbling suburb of colonial mansions, whitewashed stucco, stray dogs. It is the most beautiful thing he has ever created. Except Taiwo, he thinks suddenly. A shock of a thought. Whereon Taiwo herself, with black thicket for eyelash and carved rock for cheekbone and gemstone for eyes, her pink lips the same colour as the inside of conch shells, impossibly beautiful, an impossible girl.
That was Ghana Must Go by Thais Selassie. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit IBRShop.com. That's IBRShop.com, where small is beautiful. With powerful language and finely drawn characters, the classic Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe shimmers with the sights and sounds of village life. A Kwanko is born into poverty with a wastrel for a father. Driven by ambition, he works tirelessly to gain the prosperity of many fields and wives and to attain prestige in the village. He is harsh but diligent. But when he sees the traditions of his people eroded by missionaries and government officials, he lashes out in anger. Things Fall Apart traces the growing friction between village leaders and Europeans determined to save souls. But its hero, a nobleman driven by destructive forces, speaks a universal tongue. Peter Francis James narrates.
Unoka loved the good fare and the good fellowship. And he loved this season of the year, when the rains had stopped and the sun rose every morning with dazzling beauty. And it was not too hot either, because the cold and dry Harmattan wind was blowing down from the north. Some years, the Harmattan was very severe, and a dense haze hung on the atmosphere. Old men and children would then sit round log fires, warming their bodies. Unoka loved it all, and he loved the first kites that returned with the dry season, and the children who sang songs of welcome to them. He would remember his own childhood, how he had often wandered around looking for a kite sailing leisurely against the blue sky. As soon as he found one, he would sing with his whole being, welcoming it back from its long, long journey, and asking it if it had brought home any lengths of cloth. That was years ago, when he was young. Unoka, the grown-up, was a failure. He was poor, and his wife and children had barely enough to eat. People laughed at him because he was a loafer, and they swore never to lend him any more money because he never paid back. But Unoka was such a man that he always succeeded in borrowing more and piling up his debts. One day, a neighbor called Okoye came in to see him. He was reclining on a mud bed in his hut, playing on the flute. He immediately rose and shook hands with Okoye, who then unrolled the goatskin which he carried under his arm and sat down. Unoka went into an inner room and soon returned with a small wooden disc containing a kola nut, some alligator pepper, and a lump of white chalk. "I have kola," he announced when he sat down, and passed the disc over to his guest. "Thank you. He who brings kola brings life, but I think you ought to break it," replied Okoye, passing back the disc. "No, it is for you, I think." And they argued like this for a few moments before Unoka accepted the honor of breaking the kola. Okoye, meanwhile, took the lump of chalk, drew some lines on the floor, and then painted his big toe. As he broke the kola, Unoka prayed to their ancestors for life and health and for protection against their enemies. When they had eaten, they talked about many things, about the heavy rains which were drowning the yams, about the next ancestral feast, and about the impending war with the village of Mbino. Unoka was never happy when it came to wars. He was, in fact, a coward and could not bear the sight of blood. And so he changed the subject and talked about music, and his face beamed. He could hear in his mind's ear the blood-stirring and intricate rhythms of the Ekwe, and the udu, and the ogene, and he could hear his own flute weaving in and out of them, decorating them with a colorful and plaintive tune. The total effect was gay and brisk, but if one picked out the flute as it went up and down, and then broke up into short snatches, one saw that there was sorrow and grief there. Okoge was also a musician. He played on the ogene, but he was not a failure like Unoka. He had a large barn full of yams, and he had three wives. And now he was going to take the Idemili title, the third highest in the land. It was a very expensive ceremony, and he was gathering all his resources together. That was, in fact, the reason why he had come to see Unoka.
That was Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. Winner of a Commonwealth Writers' Prize and an Orange Prize for Fiction, Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie continues the literary tradition of Chinua Achebe in The Thing Around Your Neck, a brilliant collection of stories. Focusing on life's many clashes, tradition with modernity, African cultures with American, Adichie delivers a series of haunting, character-driven tales. Ajua Ando performs the work.
My father asked Nmabia to write a report, how he had sold the jewelry, what he had spent the money on, with whom he had spent it. I didn't think Nmabia would tell the truth, and I don't think my father thought he would either, but he liked reports, my professor father. He liked things written down and nicely documented. Besides, Nmabia was 17, with a carefully tended beard. He was in that space between secondary school and university and was too old for caning. What else could my father have done? After Nmabia wrote the report, my father filed it in the steel drawer in his study where he kept our school papers.
That he could hurt his mother like this was the last thing my father said in a mutter.
But Nmabia really hadn't set out to hurt her. He did it because my mother's jewelry was the only thing of any value in the house, a lifetime's collection of solid gold pieces. He did it, too, because other sons of professors were doing it. This was the season of thefts on our serene Nsoka campus. Boys who had grown up watching Sesame Street, reading Enid Blyton, eating cornflakes for breakfast, attending the university staff primary school in smartly polished brown sandals, were now cutting through the mosquito netting of their neighbors' windows, sliding out glass louvers, and climbing in to steal TVs and VCRs. We knew the thieves. Nsoka campus was such a small place, the houses sitting side by side on tree-lined streets, separated only by low hedges, that we could not but know who was stealing. Still, when their professor parents saw one another at the staff club, or at church, or at a faculty meeting, they continued to moan about riff-raff from town coming onto their sacred campus to steal. The thieving boys were the popular ones. They drove their parents' cars in the evening, their seats pushed back and their arms stretched out to reach the steering wheel. Osita, the neighbor who had stolen our TV only weeks before the Nmabia incident, was lithe and handsome in a brooding sort of way and walked with the grace of a cat. His shirts were always sharply ironed. I used to look across the hedge and see him and close my eyes and imagine that he was walking toward me, coming to claim me as his. He never noticed me. When he stole from us, my parents did not go over to Professor Ebube's house to ask him to ask his son to bring back our things. They said publicly that it was riffraff from town, but they knew it was Osita. Osita was 2 years older than Nmabia. Most of the thieving boys were a little older than Nmabia, and perhaps that was why Nmabia did not steal from another person's house. Perhaps he did not feel old enough, qualified enough, for anything bigger than my mother's jewelry. Nmabia looked just like my mother, with that honey-fair complexion, large eyes, and a generous mouth that curved perfectly. When my mother took us to the market, traders would call out, "Hey, madam,
Why did you waste your fair skin on a boy and leave the girl so dark? What is a boy doing with all this beauty?
And my mother would chuckle, as though she took a mischievous and joyful responsibility for Nmabia's good looks. When at 11, Nmabia broke the window of his classroom with a stone, my mother gave him the money to replace it and did not tell my father. When he lost some library books in class 2, she told his form mistress that our houseboy had stolen them. When in class 3 he left early every day to attend catechism, and it turned out he never once went and so could not receive Holy Communion, she told the other parents that he had malaria on the examination day. When he took the key of my father's car and pressed it into a piece of soap that my father found before Nmabia could take it to a locksmith, she made vague sounds about how he was just experimenting, and it didn't mean a thing. When he stole the exam questions from the study and sold them to my father's students, she shouted at him, but then told my father that Nmabia was 16 after all, and really should be given more pocket money.
That was The Thing Around Your Neck by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. Readers, during my South African journey, I spent a night at the Knysna Elephant Sanctuary along the country's garden route. I had the once-in-a-lifetime experience of watching a baby elephant being born. In addition to the birth, I was introduced to the amazing society of elephants and how they care for one another. This next selection, The Elephant Whisperer, My Life with the Herd in the African Wild by Lawrence Anthony with Graham Spence, is one I think you'll love. When conservationist Lawrence Anthony was asked to accept a herd of rogue wild elephants on his Tula Tula Game Reserve in Zululand, South Africa, his common sense told him to refuse. But he also understood he was the herd's last chance. They would be killed if he wouldn't take them. In the years that followed, Anthony became part of their family. As he battled to create a bond with the elephants, he came to realize they had much to teach him about life, loyalty, and freedom. Book Report favorite Simon Vance narrates.
I was about 100 yards away when Ondonga came sprinting up, waving his arms.
"Quick, Mr. Anthony, turn off the motor and keep quiet," he whispered. "There's a leopard about 40 yards ahead, just to the right of us."
I killed the engine and squinted into the bush, my eyes scouring every inch of the area where he was pointing, and saw nothing.
"A leopard out in broad daylight? Can't be."
Ndonga put a finger to his lips.
"I saw it just 2 minutes ago as you were driving up. Just keep still. It'll come out again. Just watch that big bush over there. That's where it came down."
The thicket was certainly big enough to hide a leopard, but leopards are primarily nocturnal, and it would be highly unusual to see one wandering around at midday. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I spotted one of the Ovambos come out from behind the house and nod at Ndonga. He was wiping his hands with a rag, which he quickly stuffed into his pocket when he saw me looking at him. Ndonga, who had been crouching near the car, stood up.
"Well, I suppose you're right, boss. Your Land Rover would have frightened it off anyway. Pity! It's the first leopard I've seen on Tula."
I nodded. We knew there were several leopards on the reserve from their tracks, and the markings I'd seen recently by the Land Rover had confirmed it, but they had been vigorously hunted before we took over, and as a result were so secretive that few had seen them. Thus, Ndonga's account of one of these beautiful, dappled cats bounding out of a tree in brassy sunlight so close to human habitation was absolutely amazing.
"So, what's happening, Mr. Anthony?" he asked. "We've let the herd out. I want all of your guards to go on patrol and track them. Also, check the fences. Make sure the power stays up. Permanently. And double-check that there are no trees anywhere even remotely close by. I don't want the elephants shorting the wires again.
I've already done that. All trees near the fence have been chopped. The last time I'd heard that was just before the herd had escaped from the boma. I didn't want to risk it again.
You're sure?
Of course.
Well, okay. See you later.
I drove off. The recent rains had brushed the bush in colours of green and gold, and the fecund earth throbbed with life. Unfortunately, as beautiful as it looked, this rampant foliage would make the elephants more difficult to track. We needed to know all the time exactly where they were in case they attempted another breakout. Biela, our loyal gardener and everybody's friend, ran up to welcome us back as Max and I got out the car, glad to be home. As I walked through the door, Francoise told me that Ungwenya, my security induna, or foreman, wanted to see me. He was sitting on a tree stump outside the veranda of the ranger's quarters about 30 yards from our house. This was unusual. He obviously didn't want to be seen approaching me. I walked over.
Sawubona, Ungwenya. I see you. Yebo, Mkulu.
We spoke for a bit about the unusually wet weather and the elephants. Then he got to the point.
Mkulu, we all know strange things are happening.
Such as what?
Such as the shooting of Nyamazen, game, on Tula Tula.
I stiffened. I had been so absorbed in the elephants that the poaching problem had been put on a back burner.
But now I am also hearing strange stories, Ungwenya continued. And the strangest of all is that people are saying that Undonga is the man who is doing the shooting, the man killing our animals.
What?
The blood drained from my face.
What makes you say such a serious thing?
Ungwenya shook his head, as if he too couldn't believe it.
Undonga shoots the buck, but the skinning is done by the other Ovambos and by Phineas, the gate guard. Then sometimes a truck with ice comes late at night, with no lights, and fetches it, or sometimes Undonga takes the meat to town.
How do you know this?
It is what the people here are saying. Also, I am told the other Ovambos are unhappy. They complain in the village that they are doing all the hard work and Undonga gives them no money. He only gives them meat, not even good meat. They get maybe the head and shins, that's all.
How long has this been going on?
Ungwenya shrugged.
Since the day you came, but I have only found this out now. That is why I have come to you.
Thanks, Ungwenya. Good work. These are dangerous times.
He eased himself off the stump.
The Ovambos must not know I have spoken to you. Saligale, Mkulu.
Stay well.
That was a sampling of The Elephant Whisperer by Lawrence Anthony and Graham Spence. In Christy Watson's Tiny Sunbirds Far Away, Blessing and her brother Ezekiel adore their larger-than-life father, their glamorous mother, and their comfortable life in Lagos. But all that changes when their father leaves them for another woman. Their mother is fired from her job at a hotel, and soon they have to quit their air-conditioned apartment to go and live with their grandparents in a compound in the Niger Delta. Adapting to life with a poor countryside family is a shock beyond measure after their privileged upbringing in Lagos. Told in Blessing's own beguiling voice and strikingly captured in Adjoa and Do's sensitive performance, Tiny Sunbirds Far Away shows you how some families can survive almost anything. At times hilarious, always poignant, this story brings you voices of characters you'll remember.
Mama waved her hand up and down as the tall woman with the blue and white plastic bowl full of soaps walked slowly toward the security gate. She did not rush. Nobody did. Even when the other hawkers realized that Mama was buying soap, that she had money to spend. They looked up at the window and shouted out the contents of their bowls or baskets or trays. Oranges, pure water, bushmeat, alarm clock, petticoats, Gucci handbags. But from where I was sitting, I did not need them to shout. I could see everything. Father worked as an accountant for an office full of government ministers in Central Lagos and had to leave the apartment very early in the morning to miss the worst of the go-slow. Ezekiel woke up extra early to see Father before he left for work, even though he was 14 years old and not a morning person. He liked to sit on Father's side of his bed next to his neatly laid out work clothes and watch him dress, pass him his tie, cufflinks, and wristwatch. Mama would tut loudly into her pillow before swinging her long legs out of the bed as Father whistled and teased her. "It's like sleeping next to a handful of needles," he would say, sharp and bony, poking me through the night. Mama would tut even louder and sometimes suck her teeth. She, too, was not a morning person. We all had breakfast together. Father ate hot food only, but lukewarm, which made his hot food only rule seem silly. Ezekiel and I ate cereal or rolls with jam that Mama had stolen from her job at the Royal Imperial Hotel. After dressing in her work uniform of navy blue skirt and white blouse and painting her lips with a tiny paintbrush, Mama would make Father's coffee extra sweet with warmed condensed milk. Then she would kiss Father on the mouth, sometimes twice. After kissing Mama, Father would have the same red color on his lips and make us laugh by pretending to have the voice of a woman. Father laughed the loudest. He always laughed at breakfast time, until he had a mouthful of food, or until our neighbor, who did not begin work until 9 a.m., banged on the wall with his knuckles. After Father and Mama had left for work, Ezekiel and I walked to the International School for Future Leaders, which had floors so shiny I could see my reflection in them. My best friend, Habibat, and I liked to sit by the fountain at lunchtime and take off our shoes and socks, dipping our feet into the cool water. Ezekiel liked the clubs and societies, chess society, Latin club, science club, but we both liked school. We liked the marble floors, cool air conditioning, and wide running field that seemed to stretch forever. It was nearly night when Father arrived home. My window was shut, the air conditioning was on full, but still I could hear his footsteps on the path, his key in the lock, and his slamming the door. Ezekiel jumped up from where he had been reading on my bed, knocking his textbook onto the floor, where it opened at a page that had a picture of a man with no skin showing his insides and arrows pointing to the different bits inside him. Descending colon, duodenum, liver. Father's footsteps thudded across the hallway before the door burst open.
"Kids, where are you? Where are you, trouble kids?"
Mama hated Father calling us kids. Father loosened his necktie as Ezekiel and I rushed over and followed him to the parlor.
"I came top in the spelling test, and the teacher said I am the best at Latin, the best he's ever taught."
Ezekiel was breathless from talking too fast. His nostrils were flaring.
We've just heard Tiny Sunbirds Far Away by Christy Watson. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Monty reels between man and beast, an unlikely explorer, the evolution debates, and the African adventure that took the Victorian world by storm is the riveting tale of an unlikely young explorer who emerged from the jungle with evidence of a mysterious, still mythical beast, the gorilla. He stumbled straight into the center of the biggest debate of the day, Darwin's theory of evolution. In 1856, Paul de Chaillu marched into equatorial wilderness of West Africa determined to bag an animal that, according to legend, was nothing short of a monster.
When he emerged 3 years later, the summation of his efforts only hinted at what he experienced. Armed with an astonishing collection of zoological specimens, De Chaillu leapt from the physical challenges of the jungle straight into the center of the biggest issue of the day, the evolution debate, racial discourse, and the growth of Christian fundamentalism. De Chaillu experienced instant celebrity, but with fame came whispers about his past and his credibility. Between Man and Beast combines his personal journey with the epic tale of a world hovering on the sharp edge of transformation. Bob Walter narrates.
He'd been hunting in the forest's depths for months, but he'd never known such silence. No monkeys shook the leaves overhead, no birds cried, no insects droned. The only sounds seemed to come from within, the pulse throbbing in his temples and his own labored breathing. The previous day, the young man had hiked what he guessed was about 18 miles before collapsing into sleep. But those trails hadn't been nearly as challenging as this one, a muddy ribbon twisting up the forested mountainside, inset with loose boulders of granite and quartz. He was in good shape and just 25 years old, but each step took its toll. He fell behind his companions, whose bare feet gripped the slippery rocks better than did his leather boot soles. His blue cotton shirt and brown pants were streaked with mud. Somewhere along the way, it was hard to tell exactly where it began, the gentlest of whispers broke through the enveloping hush. The higher he climbed, the louder it got, a breathy hiss that grew into a roar. Twisting through the overgrown vegetation, he found the other men standing on a broad, flat shelf of land. A scene like none he'd ever witnessed burst open in front of him, a vast pool of swirling water fed by a majestic torrent that spilled down the angled slope for what looked like a mile. A mist rose from the tumult, obscuring everything in a gauzy veil. The swaying ferns, the logs slanting across the water, the trees ringing the banks. According to his calculations, they were about 5,000 feet above sea level. He paused to drink from the pool, but his rest was brief. A short distance uphill, one of his companions spotted footprints that didn't belong to their own party. The feet that had impressed those marks into the mud were bare, but oddly round, with a big toe that seemed to jut away from the other four toes at a severe angle. When he saw the prints for himself, the hunter felt his heart slam against his ribcage. This was the target he'd traveled so far to pursue, and it finally seemed within his reach. Following the tracks, the men stumbled into what appeared to be an abandoned tribal village. Years earlier, the land had been cleared for huts that had since collapsed. Stray stalks of sugarcane pushed through the ruins. As the hunter broke off a stalk and sucked the grassy sweetness from its marrow, another of the men observed that some of the plants had recently been ravaged, violently torn up by the roots and mangled into pulp. They looked at one another and grabbed the rifles they wore strapped across their backs. More tracks led down a hill. The men carefully crossed a stream on a fallen log, and on the other side of the water they encountered a cluster of enormous granite boulders, some as big as small buildings. The tracks here were even fresher, filled with muddy water that hadn't had time to settle. The hunter circled to the right of the boulders, while a few of his companions walked to the left. He emerged from the granite blockade just in time to catch an obstructed view of four dark creatures fleeing rapidly into the dense cover of forest. The figures disappeared as quickly as they had exploded into view. Running with their heads down and bodies bent forward, the woolly creatures appeared to him, he later noted, like men running for their lives. Just minutes before, he might have sworn that the mountain torrent had been the most awe-inspiring sight he'd witnessed in his young life. But this blurred vision of bodies in motion, gone in the blink of an eye, blew it away.
That was Between Man and Beast by Monty Reel. When Alexandra Beau Fuller traveled home to Zambia to visit her parents, she asked her father about a nearby banana farmer known for being one tough bugger. Her father's response was a warning to steer clear. Nonetheless, Fuller began her strange friendship with the man she calls Kay, a white African and veteran of the Rhodesian War. With the same beautiful prose that won her acclaim in Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, Fuller recounts her friendship with Kay in Scribbling the Cat, Travels with an African Soldier. Kay is a man of contradictions, tattooed, battle-scarred, and weathered by farm work. Yet, he is also a born-again Christian, given to weeping when he recollects his failed romantic life and his memories of battle. His war was a brutal one, marked by racial strife, jungle battles, unimaginable torture, and the murder of innocent civilians. Fuller and Kay decide to travel from Zambia through Zimbabwe and Mozambique to visit scenes of the war and to meet other veterans. It's a strange journey into the past, marked by somber reflections and odd humor. What results is a remarkably unbiased and unsentimental glimpse of men who have killed, scrambled to survive during wartime, and who must now attempt to live with their past. In these men, we get a glimpse of life in Africa, a land with pests, plagues, and natural disasters, making the people there more hardened and more vulnerable than elsewhere. Lisette Lecat narrates.
And where the Tonga people, the nation that was shifted here in the 1950s when the colonial government flooded them out of their ancestral valley to create Lake Kariwa, look unrequitedly vengeful and correspondingly despondent. And where everyone else looks like a refugee worker, sweat-drained, drunk, malarial, hungover, tragic, recently assaulted. Down here, even those who don't go looking for trouble are scarred from the accidents of life that stagger the otherwise uninterrupted tedium of heat and low-grade fever, boils, guns, bandit attacks, crocodiles, insect bites. No ripped edge of skin seems to close properly in this climate. Babies die too young and with unseemly haste. If you count my parents and Kay, there are maybe 24 people out of a total population of about 60,000 who have voluntarily moved to the Sole Valley from elsewhere. That's if you don't count the occasional evaporating aid workers who slog out this far from hope and try to prevent the villagers from losing their lives with such apparent carelessness. And if you don't count the Italian nuns at the mission hospital who are here as a result of a calling from God. More like an urgent shriek, I have no doubt. Sole Valley is a V-shaped slot of goat-dusted scrub between the Chabija and Pipani rivers in eastern Zambia. The town of Sole has metastasized off the cluster of buildings that make up the border post between Zambia and Zimbabwe. It consists of customs and immigration buildings, a new and very smart police station, an enormous tarmac parking lot for trucks, and a series of shabby tin and reed shacks that billow tarpaulins or plastic sheeting in a feeble protest against rain or dust, and that offer for sale black market sugar, cooking oil, salt, mealy meal, and bread. "Welcome to Sole," says the sign. "Speed kills. Condoms save." People at the border post climb out of their cars and you see them looking around and you can hear them thinking, "Save me from what?" Guinea fowl, destined for a torturous journey into someone's pot, clatter from their bush tumble baskets, "Nkanga, Nkanga." And the Hoyland's robins call from the dust-coated shrubs, "It's up to you, it's up to you, up to you, up to you!" Truck drivers in diesel-stained undershirts slouch in the shade of brothels and taverns, suffocating their boredom with women, beer and cigarettes. A sign dangling above the shelves of one tavern, whose wares include not only beer and cigarettes, but also condoms and headache pills, asks, "Have you come to solve my problems or to multiply them?" Prostitutes lounge from trucker to trucker, casually soliciting in a hip-sliding sly way that hides their urgency. It's a deadly business, cutthroat and throat cut. Girls as young as 12 will sell themselves to the long-haul truckers for as little as a meal or a bar of soap. In the shade of a shack that advertises Max Barber's Arc Welding and Battery Charge now open, a truck yawns and surveys its parts, which are vomited greasily on the ribbed earth in front of it, while a young man in a shiny nylon soccer shirt has his hair braided into porcupine spikes by a woman with deft fingers. And next to a sign that says, "Relax and discus res tarrant, we sail Shima and tea," two women from the Watchtower Society sit out in the sun, with their legs stretched out in front of them, stern in their reproachfully white robes. They drink Coke and eat cakes of fried mealie-meal. There are in Africa many more glamorous and inhabitable addresses than this low sink of land on the edge of perpetual malaria. Scratch the surface of anyone who has voluntarily come to this place and who is unguardedly drunk at the time, and you will invariably uncork a wellspring of sorrow or a series of supremely unfortunate events, and very often both. Scratch and sniff. Stiff upper lips crack at the edge of the bar, and tears spill, and waves of unaccustomed emotion swallow whole brandy and coke-smelling days. These tidal waves of sadness and hopeless nostalgia, not the hankering for a happy, irretrievable past, but the much worse sensation of regret for a past that is unbearably sad and irrevocably damaged, are more prevalent when the heat gets too much, or when Christmas creeps around and soaks the senses with the memory of all that was once promising and hopeful about life. And then tight tongues grow soft with drink, and the unavoidable sadness of the human condition is debated in ever-decreasing circles until it sits on the shoulders of each individual in an agonizingly concentrated lump. Eventually, someone drinks himself sober and declares that life is short and vicious and unveeringly cruel, and perhaps it's best not to talk about it. The hangovers from these drunken confessions of titanic misery, aborted marriages, damaging madness, dead children, lost wars, unmade fortunes, last 9 or 10 months, during which time no one really talks about anything until the pressure of all the unhappiness builds up again to breaking point, and there is another storm of heartbreaking confessions. But Kay, perfectly sober and in the bright light of morning, volunteered his demons to me almost immediately. He hoisted them up for my inspection like gargoyles grinning and leering from the edge of a row of pillars. And I was too curious, too amazed, to look the other way.
That was Scribbling the Cat by Alexandra Fuller. Readers, did you know safari is actually the Swahili word for journey? So I hope you've enjoyed today's literary safari and will consider one of these titles as your next read. For more titles from around the world, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for journeying with me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.